and welcome to Climate Cheesecake. I'm Sankar, an educator, co-founder of the Herpetological Society of Singapore, and I'm currently pursuing my PhD at NUS, working on assessing potential reptile reintroductions to Singapore. Climate Cheesecake is brought to you by the Cheesecake Collective and powered by Artwaves Studio. If you like our content, please subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. Today we have a really cool guest that we're very excited to have, Nitya Lela, who's a culinary anthropologist. Nitya, could you please tell us a little bit more about yourself and what exactly is culinary anthropology?
So, I mean, I think this is a question I answer a lot. When I first started this label, you know, people were like, what is that? Like, what does that mean? What does it translate to in terms of your day-to-day work, right? But primarily, it's using food as a medium to discuss the topics of heritage, of culture, of intersectionality, equity, all of these things, right? Food is aspiration, food is identity. And it's a kind of it helps to overcome prejudice a lot of the time when you want to communicate different messages.
I think this is a really, really like relevant topic to be talking about, especially when we're talking about climate change, particularly because as we see, you know, the world transition into this sort of different time period, right, where your crops in certain parts of the world may not be as
viable anymore.
Yeah. And this is kind of, we kind of touched on this a little bit in our season one, where we talked a little bit about the idea of, like, you know, chicken shortage. Why is there suddenly this chicken shortage? Why is India suddenly not selling wheat to Singapore? All of these, like, we kind of touched on it, but really today, we thought no one better to do a deep dive into this than with you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting because, yeah, we talk about the practicalities of it, right? But there's also these intangible aspects of what food means to people. Because to me, food is about identity. It's about place as well. So it really anchors you to a specific spot in the world. But also, as climate change happens, as you know, like, trade networks start breaking down a little bit or become less reliable, it means that the way we eat and the way we think about food also changes a bit. And so, like, I think, you know, we've spoken a bit before, and I've come for some of your events. And, like, I think what's interesting is that a lot of the stuff that you do, even though it's, like, you know, like from other cultures in the world, a lot of it is local homegrown stuff as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting angle of, like, you know, so how do you even come up with these things? And what is the sort of process that you go through when you're doing these, like, sort of menus or tastings and things like that?
So I think when we started Brunch Band, it was, I have to say, none of this was very planned. It was all very organic, right? I grew up in a home where weekends, it was open house. You know, your grandma cooks a lot of food, people come to eat, it's in and out. And I think as family units got smaller and smaller, and they are getting more smaller and smaller, but we also see the return of co-living, kind of, you know, young people gathering around a table, cooking together, living together, because we missed that. And Brunch Bandits was really about that, right? Just kind of, I always say the approach was, imagine your grandmother goes on an 80-day around the world trip and then comes back and decides to cook. You know, we never aspired to be fine dining or anything. It was like food that was rustic but had a message.
Yeah. And it's no frills. I love that about it. You know, so like I went for the Pan-African menu, and then it was really fun, really no frills. And like I learned a lot about, you know, like different aspects of, you know, African cooking. And I just never knew much about, you know, Ethiopian, African, East African, South African cooking until I went for that thing.
And I think that would be the case for most, like, people in Singapore.
Yeah, it's true. But also the thing is, like, then you make links to things that you're familiar with, right? Like injera and thosai, which is a fermented sort of, like, lentil-based flatbread, right? In mainly South Indian cuisine, I think.
But I think that's what you realize, that we are more similar than we are different. So I guess for me, it's always been about food culture as an underlying theme, right? But the way we've always done it is being sustainable is a holistic approach. It's not something that you do as a trend or something that you do because, like, okay, I'm going to recycle or I'm going to buy handmade soap. It's all holistic, right? Your whole lifestyle, it should be a philosophy that you approach that with. And food is one of the primary ways. I believe biodiversity in your palate.
I love that.
And your social circle would translate to biodiversity for the planet. we first started kind of really doing it open to public in Edible Garden City's space in Rowell Road. So they took over an old shop house in Rowell Road. There was urban farming going on the inside, mushroom farming in the back. A lot of these projects and the people, this was 2013, 2014. So a lot of these projects have then now gone on to become legitimate companies that were brewing inside. So it was like, I was asking Bjorn, you know, he's like, yeah, I've just started growing some peppers. And I was like, yeah, I want to make West Indian hot sauce. And I can't find those peppers here in the markets at the time. And he was like, yeah, we're trying to grow them on rooftops or around. And sawtooth coriander, which is kind of a key ingredient in West Indian cuisine. They call it Chardon Benny.
And culantro and
Mexico. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's used in, you can't make hot sauce without it. But here it's kind of a weed. So people don't really use it. And then the Vietnamese use it in their cuisine. So it's kind of connecting those dots. And then it was just like, it was an easy access of where can we get the ingredients to cook this food that we want to do. So we made a lot of the spices and the sauces from scratch. Mustafa is great.
Yeah, I know. Everything. I found the most like niche things there. So like I was, sometimes I go to Mustafa and I look, what is the oddest spice there?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to buy that and I'm going to try to do something with that, right?
Yeah. It's, I mean, okay, so it's really interesting that you mentioned like, you know, like growing a lot of these things in our own backyard. And Singapore as a country has a lot of history with, you know, plantations, right? You know, we have Gambia plantations,
pepper,
rubber plantations, but
nutmeg as well.
Yes.
Very big,
right?
Plantation.
But very little of this, like, the plantation crop actually went to benefit the general populace of Singapore, right? It is mostly as a product that is, you know, sold.
Exported.
How do you think our relationship with growing things locally has changed over the years? And how do you think it will likely change in the years to come as, you know, with climate change, we see, you know, food supplies from overseas that we are importing become less and less reliable?
So the
big question,
the things that you guys were saying, there's three things that stand out, right? And they kind of all tie in together. One, you know, the crops that were grown in Singapore was during colonial times for the East India Company, more for that, right? And also in the people that are going to be affected by climate change, your climate refugees are going to come from post-colonial countries, generally, right? It's going to be your equatorial south and below. And the other thing is also, you were talking about, oh, you know, different people, different crops are affected and different people are going to be affected differently. But if you see, food is increasingly becoming divided by class. So doesn't matter where in the world you live, you want an avocado smoothie, you want a kale salad. That's kind of, it's defined by, okay, you're a hipster or you are working in tech or you are upper middle income. And that's what you want to eat when you go out. Acai bowls, all of these things.
Quinoa.
Yes.
Which is especially egregious, right? Because quinoa used to be subsistence staple food for Indian peoples.
Yeah.
And then now they're priced out of it.
So in gentrified. Many cases,
No, of course. I mean, avocado, you know, if you were growing drugs before, now you would grow avocado because there's cartels around it. It's that valuable a crop. And so, you know, sometimes I sit in on panels and they're like, what's the next superfood? What's the food that's going to feed the world? And you have to think, okay, you know, the next trendy, like moringa suddenly became a thing, for example. Turmeric became a thing, you know. So all these ingredients you see.
And these are all things that like I grew up like eating, like just my grandmother would make like moringa kakari.
And I think it's really funny because moringa is like, what is that? Like when I heard the word moringa, it sounds so fancy. And you're like, oh, it's moringa kire. You know, and in the Philippines, they also have a big culture of eating
moringa.
Mulangay.
Malunggay.
But what I'm hearing is that, I guess, this climate transition is essentially, especially when it comes to food, it's going to affect different strata of society differently. And how do you think those who aren't able to afford to keep up, how will they be affected? And how, you know, what can we actually do in your view?
So cities eat very differently from rural areas, right? Rural areas tend to not import much at all. So they eat what grows around them and their diets and their cuisines are defined by that still to this day. Cities, it's all about access or the illusion of access and opportunity. And it's like, okay, if I go to the supermarket, I can choose between 15 different green vegetables. They come from Australia, they come from China, they come from Vietnam, you know, it doesn't matter. But I think I have a choice. But I realize usually, like if you think about what you end up eating on a day-to-day basis, if you shop at a supermarket, you are eating broccoli, you're eating maybe cabbage, and maybe your Shanghai greens or your bok choy. Like that's as much diversity, and occasionally some kale.
Yep.
And lettuce, right? And so I think cities, when they are like, okay, sustainable diets for cities, what is that? Oh, it's alternative meat, right? Yeah. But how many people at the moment can afford alternative meat?
It's really expensive.
It's expensive, right?
I'm a vegetarian and like I just can't, like I can't justify going to the supermarket and buying Impossible meat for like so much more money than if I just bought, you know, like an equivalent amount of protein with like beans or lentils or something like that, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's and also it's the branding of food that's we're starting to see in cities. So what, okay, like imagine you eat meat, you go out, you buy a chicken. The chicken doesn't have a brand, right? You can choose the quality of your chicken depending on the grower, the farmer, the butcher, right? But it doesn't come branded. But with alternative meat, a lot of the time, because of the investment that's going in it, what you're getting is a branded product. And because it's a branded product that they own the rights to, they can change the composition of it at any time without having to tell you that they have changed.
Oh.
Anytime. So
that
it's,
just blew my mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that's, I guess that's a different approach, right? So who are you trying to feed with future foods? So then they're like, okay, the next crop that's going to feed everybody is jackfruit.
Yeah.
Right? If you are vegetarian, vegan, you're eating a vegan jackfruit burger.
Yeah.
You know, but if you go to your nasi padang shop, you go to Maimuna, you get your nangka curry with, it's, you know, there, two sides, right? It's $4.50. Yeah. Cents, $5. Yeah. I mean, prices have gone up, I guess, so $8 maybe, right? But you go get a pulled jackfruit taco 10 minutes away.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's $24, right? Yeah. And it's from a branded company that is focused on making jackfruit the next future food.
Yeah.
So buying from Geylang Serai Market, a raw product that you process, which not many people know how to do anymore, versus buying it in a tin or, you know, and then it's being sold, it's got millions of dollars in investment, it's branded, it looks good, you just tear the packet, everyone can use it. And that results in a $24 food. Yeah. So eating the same things, 2 kilometers apart, paying very different prices and earning very different incomes usually and feeling very different about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you talk about sustainable diets, what does it really mean? If you go to the core of it, what your gut really needs is biodiversity. Like you need to be eating a whole bunch of different plants on a daily basis. We still have hunter-gatherer stomachs.
Yeah.
Even though we have evolved to being convenient food societies, we have hunter-gatherer stomachs. Your stomach just wants like random wild weeds. It wants crazy things, things that don't taste so good.
Yeah, that's why I'm always hungry, I think. Just constantly needing to gather some berries.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very personal thing, right? Like you were talking, like when you're growing up, you know, you're eating your Moringa Kira, you're eating your Ponangani, which is your dwarf copper, which grows here. You're eating Agassi, all these random greens that don't taste very good, but they know how to cook it in a way that's delicious.
Yes.
But it requires a bit of skill. It requires a bit of understanding of the ingredient, and it requires access. Where are you going to buy these ingredients? You have to go to Tekka Market to buy. And wet markets close by 5 p.m. max. Right. So if you're working an office job, you're not getting access to those ingredients. You don't know how to cook these ingredients. And then when you cook them, you're like, oh, it tastes bitter. Oh, I don't know how to do it. It sucks. Okay,
I'm going
to go buy
broccoli. Sometimes it takes a long time to cook these things. You have to stew them for a long time sometimes. Yeah.
Or prepping it.
Oh, right? Yeah, prepping it. Yes.
I mean, I remember my childhood was like just picking leaves off.
The moringa. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Because that's what you do.
Yes. You, like that's how you prep it.
Yeah, you outsource the non-skilled labor, which is picking
leaves. To your children.
So how do you do it if you're living by yourself or it's just you and your partner and your kid? What do you do? What do you eat?
This to me is like a really, it's like this story that we hear with biodiversity in general where, you know, as humanity urbanizes, we disconnect from it and we aren't able to keep up with the actual diversity of things there. And eventually, like you said, we default to the simplified version, which is your bok choy, your cabbage, your whatever you get at the supermarket.
I would also like to point out that actually, like, the process of doing some of these processing things when I was a kid made me fall in love with cooking.
Yeah, right.
It made me really enjoy the process and learn and appreciate the tactile nature of it. It's almost like meditation now, right?
And some of my best memories, like, at home are just like helping my mom, like, take out the banana flour, the varapukari, right? And then just like removing the that thing.
Oh, like, you know, the banana stem, when you do that stick to get out all of the fiber.
So you guys think this is all going to become the next superfood.
Superfood, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Banana flowers, banana stems.
Yeah, and you know, jackfruit. Like in Java, in Georgia, it's super accessible, super easy. Things like tempeh as well.
Yeah. So how do you guys eat now? Because it's very different from how you were growing up, right?
Yeah.
So you are now cosmopolitan, you've traveled all over the place, you have jobs. So how do you guys eat now?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? For me right now, I'm living away from my family, and the way that I have to eat is just, what can I eat? What can I cook in this 1 hour that I have? Max, if I'm lucky, I get an hour to cook. And it's really just like subsistence. It's kind of back to subsistence now, where I'm like, I'm not cooking for fun as much, or like, I'm not enjoying that process as much as perhaps I should be.
I still stay in a family home, so things are easier. I do cook a fair bit, but I, because of the fact that like staples are done, I have a lot more time to explore and experiment and do things. So I make rendang from scratch, for instance. And it's like a super fun.
Yes.
And it's a super like, and every time I make it, I remember like, oh my gosh, we're doing things, we're taking things from the region. Like all of these plants grow here. You know, like turmeric leaf, galangal, things like that. Like these are all from here.
So, right? But that's kind of what I want to kind of share, right? Which is the plants, if you grow native edible plants or regional plants, they are almost impossible to kill. So if you grow your turmeric, if you just get some leftover turmeric, you put in a pot of soil, you get the turmeric leaf. Yeah. It's going to grow. Right?
And the makrit lime, right? Like
Yeah, but your moringa, all of these things. So I've been traveling a lot and I have some plants in a pot, right? And the moringa, I was away for a month, 2 months, and it still survives.
Wow.
So it's, if we grow these things and then we swap these things and we share how to cook these things, I think that's what a sustainable diet can be.
Right.
You know,
From our context.
Yeah. It's kind of, I think it's all about smaller grassroots. And then you create community as well. Like if you grow makrut lime, right? And he's growing turmeric leaf. And you guys exchange and you make a dish together, you know, within like five other people. And you make a dish and then you cook, right? Because it's, I think the struggle with a lot of these ingredients is they are big pot dishes.
Yes.
You don't want to eat the same curry or the same stew or the same thing for 5 days.
Yeah.
What you want to do is to share.
Yes.
So I think cooking together, having five portions from something that you are all growing one ingredient off, might be a nice way also to remember those recipes.
This is a great idea and I'm going to do it.
I love
the
idea.
I'm legit going to do it. I'm not kidding.
Incorporating your community into your cooking. That's really beautiful.
And also sharing the recipes, right? The memories of what you're, you know, and also
like stupid moments that you do in the kitchen. Like those are things that you want to share.
But also like quickening it, you know, like I put moringa in smoothies now. So why not? Because when you grow it home, it's, you get the young leaves, which are
softer.
You can eat fresh.
Yes.
Make laksa leaf pesto, make you don't have to do the traditional things with the traditional ingredients. You can adapt it to the ways that you eat.
And like, I think we mentioned before when we were talking like about this idea of how we always look to Europe for ideas, but it's nice to look at Europe for ideas in the broad scheme. It's like, you know, like pesto, right? And then bring that in and use local ingredients to try that. And that.
But you think about that. My grandma used to make this thing called a toyol.
Which is a pesto. Yeah,
it's basically pesto,
which is just basically mint and some onion, garlic. You stew it down.
Your oil is just pesto.
You just keep it and it's pesto, right? It's, without cheese.
Yeah.
You know, but there's also things to learn, right? When I mean, when you talk about Japan and when you talk about France and Europe, I was just there actually visiting all this. They have this classification system, provenance, denomination
DOP,
of origin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you see the pride they take in an ingredient. Your durian. So now, let's talk about in a local context. Malaysian durian versus Thai durian. Why is Malaysian durian so much better than Thai durian?
The terroir. Right?
No, but it's also 100 years of selected cultivation. So they took the best trees and they decided, okay, this is a value product. This is a premium product. And we are going to make this the best version of the fruit.
So basically what you're saying is think about durians in the same way we think about vineyards and wine.
Yes.
Right?
Mm. Exactly. And try and put that same approach. Don't say ingredients that are grown in the region are poor quality. It's just that right now we are focused on quantity and price versus quality. So,
And we assume that if it's from the region, it can't be that prestigious, right?
There's a PR thing to it as well.
That's a problem. Yeah. That's a problem. Yeah.
Do you feel hopeful about the way that we see our food, our relationship with food? Do you
think it can progress? I'm always hopeful. Yes. Right. I mean, but I'm a child of the city, right? Yeah. Like in my head, I'm like, oh, it'd be so nice to live in a farm. And, you know, like I had those kind of, like when I left university, I told my mom, I'm going to move to my granddad's. We have some land in India, you know, from, I don't know, 100 years ago. I was like, oh, I'm going to go there. I'm going to be a chili farmer. I'm going to live there. My mom was like, let's get real. You know, like it's not about escaping and going somewhere else and doing that. It's about trying to do it here and trying to see how do you, with all your influences, your challenges and conflicts and opportunities that you get in a city, how do you craft that, you know, that diet, the way to eat? How do you live sustainably without being an exile from society? Which is a real challenge, right? Like, do you always have to be an outlier if you're green? How do you still go out to party at night and come back and eat a biodiverse diet? Mm. What does that look like in a city? And I think it's about balance. It's not about going for 100%, just getting started.
Like 60-70%.
Yeah, like just try, right? Yeah. And incorporate, still go for the things that you remember, that you value. And so I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
That's really good.
That's really nice. That's really nice.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Nitya.
Thanks so much for coming.
No, real pleasure.
It was really like a really, really interesting conversation.
It was really,
I think
really
cool. Like got me thinking about a lot of new ways to sort of like take on some of the suggestions you made and kind of like literally like I'm going to start growing some of these things.
Yeah, and if you need seeds, we have a platform called Singapore Seed Exchange for native edible plants, so you can come and get it.
Yeah. That sounds great.
That sounds really cool.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Climate Cheesecake is brought to you by the Cheesecake Collective and powered by Artwave Studio. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at Climate Cheesecake. Go follow us!